Well, it's my pleasure to be the person to introduce Bruce Gagnon tonight. How many of you have had a chance to meet him before? Okay, a few of you. I first met him at Vandenberg Air Force Base just a little while ago on a protest that we had there, and got to see him on that tape and know how much he knows and how committed and what a straight speaker he is. Bruce's history of social activism, if you don't count the Nixon thing, is when he was working with the citrus workers in Florida in the Cesar Chavez movement, working in the unions, and he was watching what was going on over there at Cape Canaveral, and began to investigate that and learn more about it, and that led to him being to creating the Florida Coalition for Peace and Justice, which had the outcome of having the biggest peace protest in Florida when the Trident II missile went off. Perhaps some of you saw him a few years ago on 60 Minutes when he got national coverage when he did the Cancel Cassini campaign. You remember when the Cassini went off? The Cassini that could have killed us all with its 72 pounds of plutonium if it had exploded, leaving our orbit. So he's been extremely active, talking all over not only this country, but all over the world and lots of publications. And he works closely now with Helen Caldicott as her senior fellow for her Nuclear Policy Research Institute, and it's just with my great pleasure that I introduce Bruce Gagnon to you.
Thank you. Well, good evening to you all. It's great to be here with you, and what a rousing welcome with this song. It was really wonderful. Give them another hand there. In 1982, some of you might have been there in New York City for this huge demonstration. Almost a million people were there. Anybody go protesting against nuclear weapons? I didn't go, but I was watching it on C-SPAN. They showed all the speakers at the rally that day. And after the demonstration was over, they cut away to a right-wing conference. And the speaker at the conference was Lieutenant General Daniel Graham, who was Ronald Reagan's Star Wars chief. And during the question and answer period, someone raised their hand and said, "General Graham, aren't you worried about that demonstration in New York today? They say there's almost a million people there protesting against nuclear weapons." He said, "No, I think it's fantastic. They're out there protesting against ICBMs, and we're moving into space. And they don't have a clue. Let them keep doing what they're doing." And it was in that moment that I reverted back to my old cowboy and Indian movie training days. Head them off at the pass. You remember that? It was in that moment that I said to myself, "My God, I got to learn about this." And that's when I began working on space issues. And because of the presence of the Space Center in my state in Florida, where I lived at that time. I lived there 30 long, long, torturous years. I began working on that issue, and I began taking people to the Space Center over and over and over and over again. As we learned about how the military had taken over the space program, we were a little bit late because, as it turned out, and it's in the video back there on the table, we tell the story about how when the Nazis were brought to this country after the war with 100 copies of the V2 rocket that Hitler used to terrorize the cities of London and Paris and Brussels with, along with 100 members of Wernher von Braun's rocket team. They created the U.S. space program. But with them, they also, I believe, brought an ideological contamination. Because it wasn't just 100 of the rocket guys that were brought over from Hitler's Germany. Altogether, there were 1,500 of the top Nazi operatives, the former Nazi intelligence that were brought to America to create the CIA. And then there were the Nazis that were taking Jews and putting them in freezing temperatures to find out how the body would react. And they were brought over to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Ohio to create the flight medicine program for the United States. And so throughout the military-industrial complex of America, we had a seating of 1,500 top Nazi operatives. And so I suggest to you that there was an ideological contamination of the military-industrial complex. And when we look at Eisenhower's warning to us at the end of his administration, in his concluding speech to the American people, when he tried to tell us to beware of the power of the military-industrial complex, I like to believe that he was sending us a coded warning, that he was seeing something very dangerous that was happening within the military-industrial complex, that there was an ideological brew being concocted that has now come to flourish today. And so as we look at the vision for 2020 of the Space Command, where they do indeed talk about how the United States will control and dominate space, and how we will deny other countries access to space. Where is that coming from? You know, when Christopher Columbus was sent by Queen Isabella of Spain to find the New World, he came back and he said, oh, yes, I found it. And the first thing that Spain did was the 100-year program of creating the Spanish Armada. It took them 100 years to create the Spanish Armada. And the job of the Spanish Armada was to go out into the New World to protect the interests and investments in the New World. Because Columbus came back and said, look, there are plate lands where you can't imagine the bounty of them. And so, of course, Spain wanted to control the resources and the markets that would emerge in these new worlds. And this created the global war system. As soon all the other European countries, Italy and England and France and others, built their own navies because they wanted to compete with each other to control the new worlds. And they were soon slitting each other's throat, creating the global war system that we still suffer from today. Well, this is the vision for 2020. And in here, they mention this. Under a section called the historical perspective, historically, military forces have evolved to protect national interests and investments, both military and economic. During the rise of sea commerce, nations built navies to protect and enhance their commercial interests. During the westward expansion of the continental United States, military outposts and the cavalry emerged to protect our wagon train settlements and railroads. Likewise, they say, space forces will emerge to protect military and commercial national interests and investments in the space medium due to their increasing importance. So as gold is discovered on the asteroids, and magnesium and cobalt and uranium are discovered on Mars, you've been told that we're going to Mars to look for the origins of life so that we might better understand where we as a people come from. But those two little rovers today on Mars driving around, powered by plutonium, you didn't know that probably, they're doing soil identification and soil sampling. And the previous Mars orbiter missions are doing mapping of the surface. They're doing geological fact-finding of Mars so that someday they can go and mine the planet. And Halliburton, today, Halliburton is working on a drilling mechanism for Mars. These people are planning ahead. There's a document, a congressional study commissioned by the Congress of the United States. It's called Military Space Forces, the next 50 years. Congressional staffer John Collins asked to write the definitive study for Congress. How's this whole thing going to work? In his report to the Congress, the foreword of the book, signed by John Glenn, former astronaut senator from Ohio, Bill Nelson, was the congressman from Cape Canaveral. Went up on the shuttle one time. He's now the U.S. Senator from Florida. They all signed, others as well, other politicians. Signed the foreword of the book. This is wonderful. This is fantastic. It's really a seminal document. Well, in there, the author tells Congress that with U.S. bases on the moon and with armed space stations on either side of the moon, the United States would be able to control what he called the Earth-Moon gravity well. He says, think of it like a wishing well. Imagine someone is down inside the bottom, but you're at the top. You put a lid on it, they can't get out, right? Or if you control the front gate of a base, you control who gets on and off the base. Well, he said, with our armed forces lying in wait at that location, we could hijack rival shipments upon return. Piracy. We, the United States, will control and dominate space. We will deny other countries access to space. And when the day comes when we can successfully mine the sky, the aerospace industry, through the Space Command, will patrol the friendly skies and determine who can get on and off the planet Earth and who can make profit in the heavens. And so I realized that the Space Command's job is not only to give the Pentagon control and domination of the planet Earth for the benefit of the multinational corporations, but its job is also going to be to create a parallel highway, a military patrolled, controlled highway between the Earth and the planetary bodies in the next 100 years, so that the United States military, working to the benefit of the multinational corporations, the military industrial complex, that they will be able to control the shipping lanes. And so that's what we're dealing with today. I didn't always think like this. I grew up in a military family, an Air Force family. And in 1968, at 16 years old, I was working on the Nixon campaign up in the panhandle of Florida, just where the hurricane just hit up there, Fort Walton Beach, Eglin Air Force Base. My dad was stationed there. I was a young Republican for Nixon, vice chair of the Okaloosa County, Florida Young Republican Club. And I did such a good job working on the Nixon campaign. One of my high school teachers told me, "You're the reason I voted for Richard Nixon." Can you believe that? And so I did such a good job. They had this big fish fry fundraiser for Nixon. And they invited me to sit at the head table with the guest speaker that evening. You probably heard of the guy, recently died, Senator Strom Thurmond from South Carolina. So that's how I got my start in politics. And then in 1971, I tried to join the Air Force because I wanted to be a career man. And I flunked my induction physical, actually, because of an old high school football injury. So I had to get a waiver to get into the military when most people were trying to get out. By this time, we had moved to Beale Air Force Base in Northern California. That is where the SR-71, the black spy plane, was stationed. And as it turned out, my father was working on the cameras, the spy cameras on the plane, and photo reconnaissance, it's called. And I flunked my physical, so I had to get a waiver to get in at the Oakland Induction Center. And after my training, my first base, I was sent to Travis Air Force Base. There was an airlift base for the war in Vietnam. And the first day I checked into the barracks, they looked down this clipboard and said, "Oh my God, we've only got one room left. I'm sorry about that. We'll get you out of there as soon as we can. Get your bags." And we walked down this long, dark hallway, and they kept saying to me over and over again, "Really, we'll get you out of here as soon as we can." And he opened the door and we walked in, and there were anti-war posters all over the wall. As it turned out, it was the room of the leading GI resistance movement organizer in the barracks. And they were keeping him isolated because they wanted to kick him out, but they had run out of rooms. And then they forgot about me. And so at night, there was a knock on the door, and white guys would come in with chairs and sit in a circle. talking about the war, and I sat in a corner because I thought they were communists. And they were smoking pot. Now, I had heard of it before. And I promise you, I never inhaled, not one time. I never did. And then another night, there was a knock on the door, and black guys came in with chairs, and they sat in a circle. And these were Black Panthers from the cities talking about racism. And again, I thought they were communists, and I sat in the corner. It could have been the marijuana in the room. I inhaled it unknowingly, unconsciously, but eventually my chair moved into the circle. And my life was changed forever. And on the weekends, yeah, you can clap, that's fun. On the weekends, almost every weekend, outside the gate, about 10 or 12 lonely little protesters with their sign. Can you hear them now? Do you think it does any good? Do you think anyone's paying any attention? There's only 10 or 12 of us here today. Do you think we'll ever change anything? Well, little did they know that we had 15,000 permanently stationed GIs on our base, in addition to all the thousands that came and went on the airplanes from Vietnam, and that we would talk about them in the chow hall, on the job, in the barracks, and they helped my transformation. So I'm a total believer in going to the bases and to the weapons facilities, because in that process, we reach people who are doing the job. And if we can get them to reflect and change, soon enough, some of them, I promise you, will come and join us. I know it because I've seen it in my own life. And so with that in mind, I want to invite you to go to Vandenberg Air Force Base on Saturday, September 25th at 1 o'clock. Helen Caldicott's going to be there. People are coming from around the region. And this is the first day of what we call Keep Space for Peace Week, an international week where our friends around the world hold hands symbolically to say, we don't want to move the arms race into heaven. And I'm proud to say this year, Women's International League for Peace and Freedom is co-sponsoring our Keep Space for Peace Week and helping us organize this all over the world. And let me tell you about some of the people and some of the places that will be holding events during this week. Up in northern England, Yorkshire, beautiful, beautiful rolling hills and sheep grazing. And there, as you come over the crest of a hill, you see these ugly monstrosities, these big, round, golf ball-looking things. They're called radoms. And what it is, it's what's called a downlink facility. They have about 15 or 20 of these big, ungodly-looking things sitting there. And their job is to intercept all phone, fax, and email communications from throughout Europe, as the United States spies on the people of that region, intercepting all communications. And now this place is being upgraded for participation in Star Wars. And one of our friends, Lindis Percy, who's a local Quaker and a nurse and a midwife, has been arrested about 100 times at this place because she keeps climbing the fence. She keeps going in, and her and other women over the years have actually gone into the buildings at night and removed documents and are able to prove that this is one of the United States' key installations that will help direct Star Wars. Because as satellites orbit the Earth, they send their signals down to the Earth below where they are at the time. And so the United States has had to set up these facilities all over the planet that help communicate and direct with Star Wars. And they're all being upgraded. The radar facility at Beale Air Force Base, one of the key radars in this whole infrastructure. There's one on Cape Cod in Massachusetts. There's one in Darmstadt, Germany, and our friends are organizing to resist it there. There's one out in the middle, 1,500 kilometers out in the bush country in Australia, called Pine Gap. And our friends in Australia are organizing that. Now, for them to go to a demonstration, it takes them 2 days. But they do it. And so all over the world, there are now people like us that are saying, hey, look, we don't want our communities to be part of Star Wars, to be part of giving the United States control and domination of the planet and outer space as well. And so this is who we all are. And in 1992, we created the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space because we saw that this thing was getting bigger than a bread box. All right? And we needed an organizational apparatus that would allow us to educate people all over the world. And so that's what Keep Space for Peace Week is about. Helping us every year, little by little, expand the consciousness of the people around the planet. So when they go out at night and they look at the moon and they look at the stars, they begin to see it in a whole new way. You know, after I was organizing fruit pickers, from then on, every time I saw an orange tree, I saw ladders and workers and tubs and guys with emphysema going up and down the ladder who were 65 and shouldn't have been working, but they were working because they were black. You know what I'm saying? I began to see it all very differently. And so as we begin to educate people about what the plans are for space, they too will begin to see things differently. And that's our job. I want to talk to you for a minute about Bush's current plans. You know that before the election, he's already begun the process of deploying so-called missile defense interceptors at Vandenberg and at Fort Greely in Alaska. The elementary stages of quote-unquote Star Wars. Well, first of all, we know that they don't work because the testing program has not been working. In fact, they just canceled a test the other day, the third cancellation in a row, because they're terrified that they might do a test before the election, before the deployments, and it won't work. It'll make the thing look like the sham that it is. But I want to talk to you about this so-called national missile defense. The idea of having a bullet hit a bullet in deep space to protect the continental United States from attack by the rogue states. Remember, Iraq was going to attack the United States with WMD, but come to find out they don't have any. Iran is going to attack the United States with WMD, but they don't have any. North Korea is going to attack the United States with WMD, but they don't have any. But guess who's got a whole bunch of WMD? We do. I would submit to you that this idea of missile defense is a Trojan horse. It has absolutely nothing at all to do with defense. That's just the sales pitch. It's about controlling space, it's about dominating space, and it's about denying other countries access to space. In fact, at the Space Command headquarters building in Colorado, Peterson Air Force Base, on their building they have their slogan that reads, Master of Space, and they wear it as a patch on their uniform. We're going to be the masters of space. Deutschland über alles. Okay? It's not about defense at all. So it doesn't matter that the testing program doesn't work. It doesn't matter that these missile defense interceptors aren't going to work because it's not about defense in the first place, and they know it. It's about offense. It's about control and domination. And it's about using missile defense, scaring the people, getting the people to think, oh yeah, we gotta protect ourselves from WMD, from the rogue states. Sure, go ahead and take the national treasury, no problem. We've got to scare people because in that process, we then are able to tap into the treasury over a multi-generational period of time that will allow then to build the offensive systems that are underway. That's the real key. look at the research and development dollars. When a Democratic politician comes to you and says, I'm opposed to the deployment of national missile defense, they're not giving you much because, number one, there's nothing to deploy, really. But where you really want to look is how they voted on the annual appropriations for research and development. And guess what? I'll tell you a little story. Reagan and Bush, they had SDI, you remember that? And then Clinton won. And Clinton held a press conference. I'm getting rid of SDI. $3.5 billion a year at that time for research and development. It's shut down. And my friends in the peace movement began, Bruce, why are you still working on Star Wars? Clinton has closed down SDI. The $3.5 billion is gone. Well, what my friends didn't know, because they didn't follow it all the way through, was that then Clinton created a new organization quietly called BIMDO, the Ballistic Missile Defense Organization. And he moved the 3.5 from SDI into BIMDO, and they kept doing what they were doing before. And every year it got more and more and more and more money. And the Republicans and the Democrats were approving more and more and more research and development spending for BIMDO. And then George W. comes into office, and he renames it MDA, Missile Defense Agency. And now it's up to $10 billion a year, research and development. Republicans and Democrats together supporting the money. Democrats saying, let's don't rush deployment, friends. But there's nothing to deploy yet. So it's a safe position to take. But that's just the $10 billion for missile defense. You know, all these satellites that coordinate warfare, the entire Iraq war coordinated by 50 satellites on the radar screens at Peterson Air Force Base in Colorado, those satellites are in another budget, NRO, NSA, $20 billion a year, new generations of satellites for Star Wars. So add that to your 10. Now we're up to 30. Then you got NASA. NASA's been taken over by the Pentagon. NASA's every mission, according to the head of NASA, Sean O'Keefe, former Secretary of the Nuclear Navy, Bush appointed him. His first press conference, everything we do at NASA from now on will be dual use, meaning every mission will be both military and civilian at the same time. So add NASA money into this. Then Department of Energy, who's building the nuclear rocket. The nuclear rocket, Project Prometheus, with nuclear reactors. And nuclear mining colonies on the moon and Mars in the future. And nuclear-powered rovers driving around. Nuclear power in space. Why do we need nuclear power in space? Well, come to find out, we've discovered in various Pentagon documents, the Pentagon is saying, in order to fire a laser through space, we need massive power projection capabilities. In other words, we can't run an extension cord from here on up to the heavens. So nuclear reactors, the Pentagon has been saying for some time, are the only known compact source able to supply military space forces with the kind of multi-megawatt power we're going to need. That's a quote right out of John Collins' Military Space Forces the Next 50 Years report to the Congress. We've got to have nuclear reactors to power the weapons in space. So that's DOE budget. So you add that money in. And so before you know it, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, about $80 billion. And don't forget the black budget, the secret Pentagon budget that some people say conservatively is about $20 billion a year. Most of it going into space weapons development at the Skunk Works here in California and other places where they're doing this secret Pentagon Pentagon research and development. So we're talking some real cash now, friends. We're talking some big money. And so where's that money going to come from? Is George Bush going to raise taxes on the rich in order to pay for all this stuff?